Okay, good afternoon again. My name is Gilbert Martinez, and I am chapter commissioner of the Rogers Hornsby chapter in Austin, Texas. And we are supporting this fabulous Durker chapter that's put on a great convention so far. Just a round of applause for the Durker chapter. Okay, it is my pleasure to introduce the college baseball panel. The moderator for this panel is Mike Vance, a very active member of the Durker chapter. He is the executive director of the Houston Arts and Media, which has produced more than 50 feature-length documentaries and TV shows about Texas and Houston history. He's also the lead writer, researcher, and editor of Houston Baseball, the lovely hardcover book that was part of your registration. So we're very lucky to have Mike moderate this panel, and I'll allow him to introduce our great panelists here. Mike Vance.
All right. Thank you, Gilbert. A couple of housekeeping things that they wanted me to mention. The bus to the Skeeters game is going to leave at 4:30, not 4 o'clock. So we do have a little more time to play with there. And also, questions are going to be submitted in written form. And I think both back corners, there are little cards that you can write your questions down for the panelists. So let me go ahead and introduce everybody. To my immediate right is Coach Jim Gilligan. He's been the head baseball coach at Lamar University in Beaumont for 37 seasons. Is that right? Does that sound right?
It's in the vicinity.
Somewhere like that?
It's like birthdays. We stop counting.
Okay. Roughly 37 seasons. It follows his time as a player and assistant coach at Lamar and a one-year stint pitching in the Detroit Tigers organization. He's led the Cardinals at Lamar to 12 NCAA tournament bids and a total of almost 1,300 wins, a number that places him in the top six of active baseball coaches, college baseball coaches. Coach Gilligan also has been named to the Texas Baseball Hall of Fame in 2004 and has won six Conference Coach of the Year awards. Please welcome Jim Gilligan. Sitting in the middle over here is Mike Gustafson. Mike runs the College Baseball Hall of Fame and has served as the president and CEO of College Baseball Foundation since June of 2009. His baseball playing career includes time as a star middle infielder on consecutive Texas State High School tournament teams in 84 and 85 at Lubbock Monterey High School. He then went on to play baseball at Texas Tech from 1986 to 89, got his master's degree in sports management from the University of Texas at Austin, and then in 2005, he finished his doctorate at Texas Tech in higher education administration. He's also served as a radio and or TV analyst for Tech Baseball since 2010. Please welcome Mike Gustafson. And down on the end, this is Roger Clemens. He was a star pitcher here in Houston at Spring Woods High School before he went on to San Jacinto College and the University of Texas at Austin. While at Austin, Roger had a 25-7 record, threw a then record 35 straight scoreless innings, and was on the 1983 National Championship team. The National College Baseball Pitcher of the Year Award is named in Roger's honor. He has, as you probably remember, starred for the Red Sox, Blue Jays, Yankees, and Astros, winning 354 games in the major leagues, an AL MVP award with the Red Sox, and a record 7 Cy Young awards. Please welcome Roger Clemens. So I checked with Coach Gilligan. I thought for a while we were going to have the only panel here that was all people that grew up in Texas, but Coach actually grew up in New York, come to find out, and then got here. Yes, New York City. But nonetheless, everybody here was around college ball in the 80s. So I wanted to start by asking, did y'all run across each other at all during that time period?
Well, I remember Roger. I don't know if he knew that I was coaching in the third base box. But the thing about recruiting players, it's not always obvious because I feel like 90% of college ball players, it might even go to the big leagues, but they're all the same. The talent is the same. Is that 10% that have something special. And I can remember being in the coaching box over at Rice, when Charlton Norm threw his first pitch, and I said, that's a big leaguer. And I can remember watching Lance Berkman get up in double office, and I said, that is a big leaguer. And I remember the first pitch he threw, I said, that is a big leaguer. And I was right on all three counts, and it was just obvious. When you throw something, and I know nobody has a chance to hit, that guy's got a chance. As long as he stays healthy, he's got a chance to do well. But, Roger, I do remember the first pitch I got to see you throw, and I sure wish it would have been in a red uniform with white bottom instead of that burnt orange that I grew to not like very much. I got Longhorn scars all over my body. I got two Texas guys sitting next to me.
I was at Texas Tech in the late 80s, and so I missed him, and we're too far away, I guess, from Lamar.
That's true.
I don't recall us ever playing against Lamar, so I played against a bunch of really good guys that followed him at the University of Texas, but thankfully I missed that team that he played on because they were loaded.
Did y'all play Lamar when you were at Texas, Roger?
I believe so.
We played in the fall.
I was going to say in the fall. I believe it was in the fall. But again, I when I talk about college baseball and my memories, obviously at the University of Texas, we were able to play at an extremely high level and ran across some great players who went on to do great things. Or even more importantly to me, I had, even here in Houston in high school, Coach Charlie Mariano, my high school coach, since passed away. Then I had Wayne Graham, Coach Graham, who's obviously at Rice now. I had him 1 year at San Jacinto, and then I went on to have Coach Gus at the University of Texas. They were great men. They were great coaches, but more importantly to me, they were great teachers of the game. And I think that's what helped me be a great student of the game once I got to the professional ranks. But, you know, even on this panel here, and when I was around, had a great picture a month or two ago with we were able to get Coach Gus out to a ball game to stand next to Augie Garrido. And, I mean, just the history there and the wins in college baseball are incredible.
Let's talk about a few years ago they changed the bats, and scoring has dropped. I mean, you don't see as many of those 21-19 games in the College World Series anymore. In fact, this past one, homers were pretty hard to come by. How do you think that change in equipment and the lower scoring has affected the game, and does it affect at all the way people evaluate college players for going on to the pros?
Well,
and this is for all three of you. We'll just do one after another.
Well, I tell you, when it was -5, they were weapons. And it was really scary. For a third baseman to come in and charge took a lot of guts. And I think what was good about that was it put more kids in the game. There were guys that really couldn't hit with wood or the version that we have today, that were able to play and be successful. But I'm a pitching guy, and I sort of like the bats that we have right now. I wish we'd hit a few more home runs, but you can still drive people in from first base. You can still hit your doubles. We preach hitting line drives, and I think it's a great way for good players to grow up is to grow up with the bats that we're using now, because good players will hit. It's just the guys at the bottom of the lineup that are going to struggle, and there's going to be less home runs, but the games are shorter. Everybody talks about, I don't think baseball games are too long, but evidently a lot of people do. But I think it's nice when games are 2 hours, 45 minutes, 3 hours, and you get there before the restaurants close, you know. So, Mike played Texas Tech. I don't know how you recruit any pitchers to go out there with that wind blowing out. I played out there one time, and it was, I mean, you just counted every out. So I like the way it is right now, and I hope we don't go too far away from it, because I think it's easier for scouts to evaluate talent for the next level. And everybody's going out using wood in the summer, and nobody complains about it in the summer, but for some reason we complain about it during the college year.
It's well documented that scoring is down just nationally in college baseball, but I think when they get to Omaha and they play in the College World Series, and that's the most visible component of college baseball, and that stadium's kind of oriented the way it is, really the dimensions aren't necessarily unfair. I think they exactly mimic the Kansas City Royals ballpark, but it's just facing into a prevailing wind, and so you get to the spot where more eyes and more television cameras and more visibility than anything else that happens in college baseball is on the one ballpark that plays like the Grand Canyon. And it just does. And so I think during a regular season, it's not anywhere near as visible and prominent as what you see in Omaha, because in Omaha, it's a different ball game. There's no question about it.
Roger?
Well, you know, again, watching from afar and, working and doing stuff with professional level teams, and then coming back, obviously I have the opportunity to watch my third son at Texas and watch him go to Omaha and everything. I didn't like it that the home run was, even being a pitcher, that the home run was taken away from the game a little bit. And I kind of bought into the, after watching for quite some time, I bought into the idea that you're trying to win each inning. If you get a guy on, bunt him over, and I watched it firsthand. So, I mean, it's definitely a part of the game. I do believe the home run's taken out of it. Again, I don't know what the dollars are from a Division I school down to Division III school, but I would like them to see all go to wooden bats, even during the season, if the cost effect is right, or a bat can be put out there. I believe one of them is called a bomb bat or something. It's a bat that doesn't crack. I wouldn't even mind seeing that eventually getting to the high school level. I'm watching the high school kids at these elite tournaments when they're wooden bat tournaments and watch them hit with it, and I think everybody can evaluate the kid if they want. I can also tell you that I've seen kids that have signed out of high school that go to the minor leagues for one summer and swing a wooden bat and come back home. You can see the difference in their hand strength and their forearm strength just from swinging a wood bat opposed to metal. So, again, I don't know what the dollars are. We do, as parents, know what the metal bats cost. Some of them are buying one, maybe two, and they're not cheap by any means. But and the ballparks are big. They were built for that bat. I believe the College World Series Home Run Derby, I was able to see, was in a restaurant, and I looked up and I saw one of the kids hitting some pretty far baseballs out of the ballpark, and ended up running to a pitching coach that knew what was going on. He said they were using Major League Baseballs in the old aluminum bat, yeah. So that explained that deal. So it made for great entertainment. But, I would go all the way back. I've bought into when you get a guy on, bunt him over and try and win the inning right now in college baseball.
You know, Coach Gilligan, you may know this, but I've heard some of the guys that coached a long time that were around for the transition from wood to aluminum, and they had talked about, you didn't hear them talk about it being a performance issue. It was because you were breaking so many bats. It was because you could buy two or three aluminum bats and use them all year. Isn't that right?
That is correct, and they were logs. Those first ones, the Adirondacks, you had to be a man to swing that bat. You could back over going out of your driveway and you couldn't break the thing. So it was a cost. It was a cost thing back then, but since then it's different. And when they were minus five, if you took one of those bats out in batting practice, it would be illegal for a game. It would flatten out. So then the cost really went up, unless you had a deal. And most of the good D1 programs did, but Roger, it probably wouldn't have made a difference to you when you pitched because you struck out 4,500 guys, so they could have hit with lightning rods and you wouldn't have complained. But I think they need to be just a little bit better than they are right now. But the problem that I have with metal bats now is that they're so easy to tamper with. So you have guys that have bats that are similar to what they were 10 years ago by taking the rings out inside, and there's no way to tell. And if you got up as a hitter and you hit a grand slam and the top came off and the rings are not in the bat, there is nothing in the rule that says your home run is taken back, which is something that you're at a level, they're not going to listen to me, but they might listen to you. There needs to be some type of penalty for people that use illegal bats, because the illegal bats, you can still hit home runs with. Promise you.
Let's talk recruiting a little bit. Roger, I'm assuming you had multiple schools that were offering you when you came out of Spring Woods. What did you look at to pick a school? What were you looking for, and what impressed you about Texas?
Well, and coming out of Spring Woods across town here, I was really the third best pitcher on our team. I didn't throw very hard, and we had some 19-year-old seniors that threw hard. Actually, some people might remember that Rick Lucan came out of Spring Woods. Rick was a very established pitcher in high school. I believe he was a 19-year-old senior. And, of course, everybody, U of H coach, Rainer Noble. Rainer was probably a left-handed pitcher and probably our best athlete in the school. So if they got in trouble in the game, Coach Mariano would bring me in. I've always been a power pitcher, not a power thrower, and it's a big difference. So when they got in trouble with velocity, Rainer had exceptional control. I threw strikes and I had a little bitty curveball. I could, you know, coach teased me that if they turned the lights out in the stadium, I could throw it over. So he would bring me in. I was a 17-year-old senior. I was very young. And some of the four-year schools were intimidating to me as a youngster. Made a big difference. For me, it did. My father passed away when I was 9. My mother raised 6 of us, and so she was my and she loved sports, thank goodness, and encouraged me to play. But it was a blessing for me because I ended up San Jacinto right down the road, and I got to play for Coach Wayne Graham. I grew, got stronger. He gave me some great tips, great teaching of the game, and my fastball jumped a little bit, and I ended up at the University of Texas. So the recruiting part of it there were a few more schools when I had the opportunity to go to Texas once they learned that I was not going to stay at San Jacinto for both years. The recruiting came about, and at that point in time, really, the University of Texas in Dish Falk Field was, it was like the Astrodome, you know. It was a little bit better in every place, and you just wanted to go to Texas to play, and if you got that opportunity, you should take it. So that's how it came about for me. A little different than the boys. My boys now and some friends of mine, kids who we talk to, the recruiting is a little different. And quite honestly, I stay out of it because I don't know as an alumni what I'm allowed to do and what I'm not allowed to do. So I kind of stay.
You're not allowed to do anything, yeah. Roger.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, nothing.
Send them all to Lamar. That's what he wants.
I think I had a pair of burnt orange shoes on and one of the kids wanted them. I said, I don't think I can give them to you. So I stay, you know, I take a step back. I remember once I turned professional and being on campus and I could only give the youngster, when he was being offered a pro contract or the opportunity to come play at school, I could just tell him about my experiences attending the University of Texas. So that stuff's crazy.
No, you can't.
Can't do that anymore either,
I guess.
Can't do
that anymore.
It was funny, just as an aside, Oliver Luck, of course, was running the Dynamo here, the soccer team, and his son Andrew Luck was looking for where he was going to go to school. And Oliver said he heard from more coaches that he hadn't talked to in 20 years than people he never remembered. Hey, man, how you doing? Haven't talked to you in a while. So, yeah. Mike, you grew up in Lubbock,
yeah.
And decided to stay right there.
Yeah, and it was really easy for me. Played at Lubbock Monterey and played on a couple of very good high school programs with Bobby Magle, who, along with Ray Knobloch, here at Houston Bel Air, kind of two. If Texas high school baseball is a Mount Rushmore, those two guys are on it. And so my dad on the faculty at Texas Tech, and so my decision to go there was easy. I mean, I think the recruitment was, I got to go over to the dining hall one day and said, well, you want to come play here? I said, yeah. So now I had no business. My freshman year, I sat over there and maybe got 10 at bats and 8 sunflower seeds, which was exactly where I belonged once I'd seen a little bit of it. It was a developmental situation that was, I was in over my head at the very first, but recruitment for me wasn't like being a highly recruited situation now. And you know, back then everything was done out of the high school program, and now so much more of it is run through summer programs like Roger had mentioned, and Coach Gilligan can speak to that obviously a lot more than I can, but that thing has changed entirely from when he and I were going through.
Are there pressures that came about with you staying in your hometown, or distractions that might not have been there if you'd been somewhere where you didn't know everybody?
Not really. At that time, you know, of course, Texas Tech just got through going to Omaha for the first time ever, and you know, there was a few stadium improvements and some things that had started to happen at that point. See, there's a recruit calling coach right there.
I knew I'd turn that off.
It's a big left-hander. You better take that call. Real pressure. I mean, college baseball at that time. You know, the Texas and A&M and Arkansas, to a lesser extent, had facilities, and what Roger was talking about, you know, they were on another plane. The rest of us were playing in, you know, in stuff that you would expect to see in high school programs now in terms of facilities and stuff. And so it just didn't. I've got an aerial photo of my last non-conference home game at Texas Tech, and a guy that I had always put on my pass list had said, I'll fly over the thing and take a picture. I didn't know he was going to do it. And there's about 25 people in the stands. I could see a little dot, and I go, there's my mom and my dad. Last week I was in an event, and there was an aerial photo of the Super Regional ball game that Tech played in to clinch to go to Omaha, and it was packed. And I thought, here's the before and after right here. You know, there's some bugs had eaten some worms, and grubs had eaten some dead spots into the infield, you know, in 1989, and now the place is packed and it's beautiful. It looks like a, you know, looks like a pro ball situation.
Coach, when you go out and your staff goes out and they're looking at guys to recruit to come to Lamar, explain the differences of what a major league scout is looking for in a high school player.
Well, of course, major league scout, if you're looking at middle infielders, you want them to run 6'8 or below. Corner guys, you want them to be big, strong kids. Same thing, corner outfielders. You want a center fielder that can, you know, that's a burner, that can really cover ground. We want the same thing, but we don't get it. You know, so every now and then we trick a kid into, you know, kid's got a girlfriend, he wants to stay around, that type of thing. I go to New York, and I recruit kids out of New York because I can offer weather. We just signed a kid that turned down $200,000. That doesn't happen very often. A center fielder that can really play, a big first baseman, over the lights power. But usually at a Lamar, we're going to have to take a kid that's missing a tool. So, for instance, somebody that comes to mind would be Kevin Millar. When I took the job back, I left Lamar for 5 years, went out and did a little bit of pro stuff, and when I was coming back, a buddy of mine had coached Kevin. I saw his stats. I knew that he was a good hitter. I knew that he could hit just by his stats. And he worked him out. He had a team workout. And he hit Kevin about 20 ground balls, and Kevin caught about four of them, wore the others on his face and chest, and promptly threw it over to first base. And he got up to hit, and he was swinging as hard as he could, and everything was up to shoot. And I love them. You know, there's just something about it. And so for a team like Lamar, it's different. When Cliff would go out, you're looking at guys that you're looking for Roger, and you're looking for guys that are major league talent guys. We have to find guys to get in that 10% that I talked about. We need to find guys that have that burning desire. There's something about them that's different. And I asked Kevin, I said, are you coachable? He said, oh, yeah. And now, if you get Kevin's story about how he was recruited, it's not true. Everybody was after him, and, you know, I did a great job recruiting. It really wasn't the way it is. I really think that we were his best shot. And he came to school, and he was just tough off the charts. And every really good player that I've had has been that guy. And when I went on to pro ball, I had a team in Salt Lake, and we won 29 straight games. I always like to say that one of the keys to managing is knowing the guy in the other dugout that you don't want to pitch to and the guy that you have that they don't want to pitch to. I had five guys that were the guy that you didn't want to pitch to. That's what we look for. We look for the guys that really are really tough. And if Roger didn't show up, I have some good tough stories about him that guys have told me because he was a tough guy on the mound, and if he didn't have that great fastball, he would have found a way to beat you. That's what we're looking for. We're looking for guys that have something special here and here and there, you know, in the guts that will make them that 10% guy.
You brought up Kevin Millar. Let's go back down the row here. Mike, tell me about the most memorable teammate and it could be toughness or whatever you want to talk about. Most memorable teammate you had at Tech.
Played with a guy named Donald Harris. And since Cooperstown happened the other day, he was drafted, I think, two slots ahead of Frank Thomas. So, and everybody's heard of Frank Thomas. There's only a few of you that remember Donald Harris. But Donald had he'd been the Southwest Conference Defensive Newcomer of the Year in football. He was a striker at strong safety. And he was a physical guy, and he came out, and we thought, well, this is just his way to get out of spring baseball. And I remember the first day, me and Brian Roper, his father was the football coach here at Houston Bel Air for years, and me and Brian are in there in the pitching machine, and pitching machine uncorks one, and it smokes Donald on about the fifth pitch, hits him right in the ribs or leg, and we're thinking, well, he'll be gone. You know, he's not going to put up this. And Coach Hayes made him get a haircut and just all of that stuff, and he kept coming around, and he was really raw. And, I mean, and in the 18 months I was around him from about January of 88 to May of 89, he went from, you know, being a football player to the whatever he was, the fifth or seventh or ninth player taken in the draft, and he just had tools off the charts. He ended up playing a little bit in the big leagues and, you know, hit 20 home runs or so in AAA. He was kind of a 4A hitter and never really established himself in the big leagues. But you talk about a special guy, and we got into a fight one time at the University of Houston, and I was at the plate, and I missed the suicide squeeze. I got the sign. I just didn't get the bunt down. We have a rundown, a collision, a bunch of other stuff, and then there's a pretty good scrap at home plate. And then Donald, and there was a football player from University of Houston that was in the outfield for them, and those two had a real fight over there. The rest of us were just kind of hugging and rolling around, and they were over there trying to kill each other. But Donald Harris is my answer to that question.
Roger, who do you remember most from Texas?
From the University of Texas? Well, I had in 1982 we lost to Miami. I think you end up tying for third when you get knocked out towards the end there. And being a sophomore at the time, we had a pretty good pitching staff as sophomores. And but one of our, you know, one of my favorite players and still is Spike Owen. And Spike played shortstop. I think he's working with the Rangers organization still now. And I believe Spike was the number one pick for Seattle, but I enjoyed everything that he did and how he led our team at Texas. And when we came home, I mean, I remember tearing up that that was our only shot to get to the College World Series. We just lost our leader, and I mean, he was, you know, now that I look at numbers and hear things as he approached and broke some of James Street's records there. But Spike was a fantastic player. He did everything well, and he played the game the right way. So I was pretty upset. But then, fortunately, we came back the next year and beat Alabama in the finals to win the College World Series. And I had two great pitching mates in Calvin Schiraldi and Mike Capel. And Kurt Killingsworth was somewhat of our closer. But just ran across a bunch of great names. I mean, I remember facing John Elway. He was playing right field for Stanford. Obviously, he could throw a little bit. I don't remember how he hit, but he could throw a little bit. And
he hit four doubles against me.
Did he?
Yes, he did. I had a great scouting report.
Okay. Then you guys are responsible for getting him hot before you sent him our way. But Palmeiro and Thigpen and Will Clark, I remember having to come out of a regional tournament and beat them twice. And just good memories when I see those guys in Austin or around town. Some of them live here in Houston. When I came home to pitch for those three wonderful years here in Houston, I got reacquainted with some of the guys. I didn't realize some of them lived here in Houston. They all came out. But, I mean, there's just – you run across some great players that did something well for your team to help you win.
Where does – given your great major league career after that, where does that 83 college title rank?
It still ranks right up there. There's no question about it. I have great memories from when you win a championship. There's and you get that distance. There's friendships and memories forever. You know, you're looking at your ring or you go back to the alumni games. I think it's very important for schools to continue to do something to encourage their alumni to come back, so they can bring their grandchildren and so on and so forth where they played, whether they were an All-American or they were the number five pitcher or what have you. So I just think that's real important to do that. And, you know, you see different teammates that are fortunate not only getting into minor league baseball to have opportunity to make it to the major league. So I just had great teammates all the way through.
Coach Gillian, almost 1,300 wins. That's a lot. Do you, and roughly 37 seasons, whatever that number is, how much of that is a formula that you've come to create over the years, and how much year to year do you adjust to the talent on your team?
Well, I think that I would recommend to anybody that is going to get into coaching that you find a mentor. And I had one in Al Vincent, and I was just listening to someone talking about Hank Greenberg in the Texas League. Al was the winningest manager in the history of Texas League. He won at three different cities, 42 years in professional baseball, and I met him in Beaumont and asked him to be my assistant coach, and he did that for 14 years. Now, prior to meeting Al, I thought that I was a guru. And 10 minutes into talking to Al, I realized I didn't know anything about the game. And I listened to him, and and I listened to everybody that has something to say about it. And, it's, you know, I'm a thief. If you're good, I want to know what you're thinking. Dirk and I have played golf probably 200 times together, and we always have a great conversation and come up with something that that adds to what I know. And I do that with everybody, but Al was, he was my Bible. And to the extent, one time I had a young assistant coach who handled our outfielders, and he did something in an inter-squad game and that I didn't agree with. I said, Andre, you can't do that because, I forget what the situation is, and he said, well, I disagree, Jim. I said, well, you can't do it because, and I said, go to Al. In other words, go to the Bible. And Al says, well, it's all according. He says, all according to what? He says, all according to whether you want to keep your damn job. You know. So he was pretty quick with you, but he was always right. This guy was always right. And so I was fortunate to have him. Roger, I know that just mentioning the people that you played for, and I know that like having guys around like Nolan Ryan, I'm sure that guys like that had an effect on you that put you over the top. And you can't do it by yourself. There's too many guys that know things that you need to know, and you need to latch on, listen, shut your mouth. If you're the smartest guy in the room, they're asking the questions, talk, but shut your mouth and listen to these guys, and it's amazing with those, especially the old-timers. This game, it's hard to improve on how to do it, and I can give you examples of how it used to be better than it is now, and some areas where we're getting better now, but that guy was a godsend to me. And that's so if you don't like what I'm doing, you blame Al Vincent.
Roger, you kind of skirted around it earlier, but you're in a somewhat unique situation of having one son that went straight to pro ball and another that went to college. And I'm sure you gave them advice of, you know, to a certain extent, do what you want to do. But what were your true thoughts there and you know, when both of them were facing that choice?
Well, Kobe is my oldest, and you know, he's worked extremely hard to try and work his way to the majors. He got as far as AAA, and but it was his dream to be a professional player and chase those dreams and be a professional hitter and you know, work on that part of it. You know, we waited between going to the university and seeing where he's at, depending on where he was drafted and everything else like that. So. When it came down to it, you know, he decided he wanted to go chase his dreams. So you just get behind him and support him and give him the information you can. My second son has a restaurant here. He played the game of that, excuse me, that wonderful game of football. Had both kneecaps reset, and I said, let's try something different. So he graduated from Le Cordon Bleu in Austin. He has catch 22 down here on Durham. So then comes along Casey and. Both my two young ones throw right, bat left, and Casey had a nice year over here at Memorial. And when he just wanted to attend the University of Texas and get into the business school, which I'm happy to say he's going to be. So that's the most important thing. I try and encourage him. I mean, you alluded to it. I'm talking, you know, when I see our manager here in Houston and handling personalities and handling kids and knowing how to stroke 25 different guys, and including myself, whether I'm a veteran or you're a younger guy, and put them in situations where they can succeed. I just think that's so important, and that's what I do with the kids. I'm, you know, at times we'll have talks where it's a more of a professional talk about the game, but most of the part I just try and be their dad and tell them how difficult this game is. And, you know, we all talk about life lessons that the game of baseball teaches you, but it's a very difficult game to play. The failure rate is extremely high, and I think pretty much to the point, most kids in Double A that I see in Double A have the ability to play in the major leagues. They have the stuff, they can play in the majors. They just can't handle the failing once they get there. It's very difficult to continue to pick yourself up. I remember one story. Kobe was in about a 2-4, 18 or 19 at bat. You know, got two hits in about eight. So he's in a slump, I guess. And word got out is when I was with the Yankees, and Derek Jeter heard the conversation. He said, "Give me the phone." He tells Kobe, he goes, "I'm in a 1-for-32 right now, Kobe. My one hit was a swinging bunt. Call me when you're in a slump." So it's at every level, I think. And it's great to be able to have you know, other people and coaches and different, when I see something that I really, from a manager or a coach that is teaching the game or something's really in an article that I like, I really try and grab a hold of that because I can learn so much, and it's just the way it's said. I've always said that with my pitching coaches. Thank goodness most of my pitching coaches never messed with my mechanics too much, but they said something that clicked or worked for me. I had one pitching coach that was a rookie, and I'll leave his name out. But during my bullpen session, he would talk to me, and he was obviously a rookie pitching coach, but and I was a veteran player. He would talk kind of out of nervousness, and so I stepped off the mound. I said, "Keep an eye on me. Here's my hot points. Watch those hot points for me so you can be my watchful eye." And I think it helped him as he grew as a pitching coach, and it was great for me because, again, he knew where my hot points were. One of my earliest pitching coaches, Bill Fisher, who still, I believe, works for Atlanta Braves, was fantastic. He got to the point where he could just basically holler my name or whistle at me from the dugout and point at my chin to lower it or my shoulders flying. And I took pride in being able to put that into play within two pitches, to correct myself, be my own pitching coach in some sort and fashion. But again, right now, go all the way back. Casey's enjoying his time at the university, and we'll see where it goes from there.
Without naming names, kind of a follow-up to what you were just talking about there. Without naming names, did you see or have you coached run into somebody that, when it comes down to it, they're just not going to listen to what advice you're giving them?
Players?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, well, listen, you know, and again, I go back to Al on this. A lot of times, a player has to be ready to learn before you can teach them. And if they have something, if something's going through their mind while you're telling them something, then it's useless. So Al used to say, let them fail. Give them a chance to fail. Then let them come to you. Then they're ready to learn. But if the first day in, you're changing things up, and you recruited them because they're successful, and they wouldn't be on your team if they didn't already display some ability. So you've got to watch out. And I find that the younger you are, the quicker you are to go in and try to tell a kid how much you know about the game. And so I feel like I've gotten a little bit better at that. But you know, a player has to be ready to learn. And when I grew up, I never had a pitching lesson. And nowadays, you know, it's select baseball. It used to be community baseball. Your team would beat the next town. You go on, you play. Everybody played Little League. Now it's select. Now, select doesn't mean we're selecting you because you're really good. Select means you can pay by check. Select to pay by check, cash, or money order. And there's a lot of money in the teaching of the game. Now, that's the way it is right now. So you have to find, if you're a young player coming up, you got to find a select team that has a guy that teaches. And but I grew up watching the 61 Yankees, so I could imitate every guy in the batting order. We played stickball. I did Bobby Richardson, Tony Kubek, Mickey Mantle. I hit best out of my Mantle for some reason, Roger Maris. I pitched with my Whitey Ford. I played against a guy that was the Dodgers. If I mixed in my Sandy Koufax and struck him out, it didn't count because I didn't use a Yankee. But you imitated people. And it's so much easier to learn when you're trying to copy a hero. So I use you. I use Nolan Ryan. I use, you know, anybody that I think might be what my guy's trying to be. I've got one of my pitchers here. Will Hibbs, stand up. Where's Will? He pitches for you. Now, Roger, I'm allowed to do that. See, because he plays for me. Now, if I was a booster, I couldn't do that. Okay. And by the way, Roger, you can give me all the equipment you want. I can sell it and send a little money back to Augie. That would be that's good.
Love that.
But getting back to learning, visual learning, playful learning. You learn when you play. So the more you play, the better you're going to get. You learn when you see things and you try to imitate. To do it from someone telling you how to do it is tough. It's more of an overall thing that you have to, I feel, that you have to look at to be able to teach.
Anything to add to that, either Mike or Roger?
I think kids now, you just said it, Coach, kids now get more instruction at a younger age. And if anything, it's some of them need to kind of pull back on, hey, how's my elbow? How's my front side? Hey, you're 14 years old. You're 16 years old. Let's not worry about your front side. You know, I mean, just play. And there's probably more of that where back in my day you got meaningful instruction from somebody that really knew something. It was a rarity. Now they get a lot of information coming at them, and there's so much available quality stuff too, but there's so much available that it's, you know, don't get out of your head and just see ball, hit ball. You know, that's an observation I've had.
Well, it's like golf in that you can get too many things to think about out there, and it messes you up. Mike, I want to give you a chance to talk about the College Baseball Hall of Fame for a little bit, because it's something that you've really gotten built up here pretty fast.
Yeah.
So tell us a little bit about that.
You know, in 2004, we had followed the lead of a group of us there in Lubbock had seen the Johnny Bench Award, which is given to the top collegiate catcher in the country by the Greater Wichita Area Sports Commission. And the analogy there would be like the Lombardi Award or those kind of position type awards for football. You're probably familiar with them, the Biletnikoff and those things. And we'd seen this Johnny Bench Award. Was created by Wichita to give to the top collegiate catcher, and we thought, you know, we could do a top shortstop award. The guy that played at Texas Tech in the late 70s and early 80s named Brooks Wallace, good player, played a couple years of pro ball, an all-conference caliber guy. Came back at Texas Tech, finished up his degree, got married, had an 18-month-old baby, and died of cancer. And so we thought, what a, you know, kind of a unique way to tell his story and keep his name alive. And after we had done that a couple years and presented that award, we thought, four or five of us thought, you know, we need to call College Baseball Hall of Fame and let them know that we've got this award and see if they're interested in it. And what we came to learn is that the entity that was out there was really the American Baseball Coaches Association Hall of Fame, and that's really it's just for coaches. There's no player recognition at all. And so, you know, to be honest with you, we probably didn't know what we were getting into at the time in terms of the level of difficulty that's involved in. You know, if there's a elevator speech from this point forward, we ran the thing for about 4 years as volunteers, decided we need to hire somebody. I stepped off the board and became the lone employee at the time. We got 5 acres of land donated in downtown Lubbock for the site for this thing. Got a $5 million grant from the Moody Foundation, which is down here in Galveston, and then finally, most recently here about a year ago, well, about 9 months ago, we announced that we'll name the building, the Hall of Fame building, for President George H.W. Bush, 41. And really, as the most distinguished alumnus of college baseball, guy was a good player, but it's not about him as a player. It's the fact that he went on to do what he did and be the president of the United States. And so we're not only going to name the building after him, but we're going to create a distinguished alumnus award that'll go to others like him that are, you know, basically a college letterman who goes on and does great things in life. And so, you know, we still need another couple million, I guess, to really get to our construction goal, but we're going to break ground on a phase one here in the next 6 to 8 months and get going on it. We've inducted 9 classes, and it's going good. It's like I said at the very beginning, it's not as easy as you would think. I don't recommend it if you're you're thinking, let's go out and start a Hall of Fame. If you're really going to go out and try to fundraise and do all that, it's a big job. It's a lot harder than it looks.
Got some questions from the audience. Roger, can you talk a little bit about the transition going from college baseball to pro baseball?
Well, simply put, I took a step down, leaving the University of Texas. I'm kidding. I missed the university. I think when I signed, we won the College World Series, and 2 weeks later I was in Winter Haven, Florida, and I think the College World Series, at least there was, even back then at Rosenblatt, there was 20, 22,000. I think at one point they roped off some of the outfield, the sidelines, and put fans down by the side warning track, if you will. And 2 weeks later I find myself in Winter Haven, Florida, and there are 11 people in the stands. And I can see the guy in the red shirt calling me a bum. So, I mean, like, wow, there's a difference there. No, I loved it. What I can remember about coming out of Texas in the draft, I believe, I thought that I might have a chance for either one of the home state teams here. I believe the Texas Rangers had the 3rd pick and the Houston Astros had the 5th pick. And I had seen them quite often when I was working at Texas, the different scouts that were popping out. I saw the Dodgers a little bit. Never saw the Boston Red Sox local scout or whatever, a regional scout. And let's see, the Rangers took a shortstop named Jeff Kunkel, I believe. And the Astros drafted a catcher named Robbie Wine. And once the Red Sox drafted me, the only other team, I think, to pick right behind the Red Sox was the Los Angeles Dodgers, and that was the only other hint that I had. So, but it was great. Remember my trip to Boston. My mother was a big historian, so she kind of gave me some cliff notes about the Boston and the Boston area. And I remember when the Red Sox had me eventually come to Fenway for the first time to see a game and see Fenway Park. The starting pitchers were Dennis Eckersley and Jim Palmer, but I pulled up. I had my head down in the cab, and the cabbie pulls up, and he says, "There you go, kid, get out." And I look kind of just out the window, and it's a brick building. looks like a warehouse. And I say, "Hey, cabbie, I'm going to Fenway Park. It's a baseball field." And he goes, "Get out. This is it." And I got out, and I saw the brick, and then the lights, and then, of course, the unbelievable sight to walk up my first tunnel, and there's the Green Monster standing in front of me. So it was a pretty neat experience for, I believe I was 21 years old. So Coach alluded to it earlier. I had the fortune to play with Tom Seaver. You're talking about keeping your mouth shut and paying attention to detail and learning a lot. I was able to watch Seaver late in his career, add and subtract off his fastball, and he was when I talk to young pitchers now about being he was the type of power pitcher you want to be. He was not a power thrower, he was a power pitcher. So when he didn't have 92, 93, whatever it was, he would still have feature other pitches and get you out. Had the opportunity to talk to Gibson. Again, I wish I'd have kept a better diary or book on all this stuff. I have it in hopefully my mind won't go too soon. I had a great conversation with Don Drysdale on his radio show when he was interviewing me one time in Winter Haven, Florida. And then just have the opportunity and the blessings to play at Fenway Park and Old Yankee Stadium. And, the boys see the black and white videos of it. And I spent 7 years right there where Lou Gehrig gave his speech, and a number of years in Fenway where Ted and Yaz ran around those bases. So it was a big blessing for me in my career.
One of the questions kind of follows up on something you just mentioned about power pitching. It seems like everybody is looking for those pitchers that can throw 95. Is there any place anymore for junk ball pitchers?
Yeah, Lamar. We'll take it. Right now, most guys couldn't scout if they didn't have a radar gun. You have to look for kids that can pitch. We had a kid that was Pitcher of the Year in the Southland. He threw 84, 85, had a great pickoff move. He could pitch to Ray Charles. You know, he put the glove down and he hit it. But the emphasis more than ever is on velocity. And, you know, the gurus of pitching nowadays, you never hear them tell you how to throw the fastball here, how to make it move, how to throw a curve slider. All they're talking about is this and this and this and that and trying to get the ultimate fastball, and you're seeing more Tommy John surgeries. Now you're seeing them on Little League kids because everybody's just trying to throw as hard as they can. So you should throw as hard as you comfortably can. If you're going to be a starting pitcher, you can't go out there throwing 100%, I don't think. Roger, how hard? What was the percentage that you threw at as a starting pitcher?
I probably sat at about 94, 95 in my prime, and I could touch a higher number, but I pitched at that level.
But what percentage of effort?
It was probably every bit of 95%.
Okay. But, you know, I think 100% is reserved for guys that are coming in for an inning.
100% would have been when I'm 0-2, 1-2, and I'm trying to get a ball on the outside corner. I'm trying to really get behind that baseball.
Well, you could. That wouldn't have made a difference for me. You know, it was easy to do that with that arm. Try to do it with this arm right here. I was the guy that you asked the question about. You know, I was a guy that could pitch a little bit when I was playing. So, and especially left-handers. You know, left-handers usually aren't good until their second operation, and that's when it starts doing this type of stuff. So yes, there is room. That's the great thing about baseball. Is there's several ways to be great at it. I don't care if you're talking about a hitter or if you're talking about pitching. There are several different styles in the Hall of Fame. Some threw real hard, some really knew how to pitch. But for me, if a guy can throw hard enough to where you can't just sit on his breaking stuff and look for it, if he can throw hard enough to where you have to respect it, yes, there is a place for you. And yes, you can make it to the big leagues. It's just a little bit harder.
You know, to bring that back to something we talked about earlier, I think one thing that you hear coaches talk about, college coaches who've been around the game with it since the equipment transition, with these bats the way they are and the ball doesn't fly like it used to, and so you see more guys coaching, you see more pitchers not afraid to pitch to contact. You know, we're back in the late 90s, if you pitched to contact, it meant you were going to give up three or four home runs in a ball game. With the minus five bats the coach was talking about earlier, now you really can get the kid and work in the bottom half of the strike zone and change speeds and get outs. And so I think it's a better environment for pitchers, but it also they create a better mindset as they climb up the ladder because they're not afraid to pitch to contact. And that just wasn't the case in the late 90s. You had to miss bats back in those days to win in college.
We got time for one more question. I did want to thank everybody for being here and mention that we do have a session immediately after this in this room. So if you're not staying for the session, probably start fairly gradually heading toward the outside. Obviously, all three of y'all are committed to college baseball. Tell me the pluses for a player. Hopefully this isn't too much of a softball question, but the pluses for a player going to college. And is it something that, how much of it is an individual case-by-case basis, whether or not it's best for that player? Start with you, Coach.
Go ahead, Coach.
I think that most kids, regardless of talent, should go to college because 18, 19, 20 years old, I think it's important to go through that social aspect of being in college. I think it's good for you. I think an 18-year-old kid that gets on the road, especially if he signed a big contract, some of the towns and the nutrition. You know, my cafeteria is better than an 18-year-old's going to feed himself all by himself. And I just think that is the big advantage. Plus, you're getting a degree or you're working towards a degree as you're going to school. So if you are truly a big leaguer, and you wait till your third year to sign, well, unless they were wrong, you're much better off. And if they were wrong, you're better off too, because at least you got 3 years towards a degree. If I can get a kid through his third year, I can get him graduated. You know, so I think every kid should go. Every now and then you get a kid that's super mature, he's a no-brainer about going there. But they're very rare cases. I just think a kid is better off going to college.
Mike?
I think in 2010, opening day rosters, 52% of those of the players on opening day rosters had signed out of college at some level of college baseball, and I think it was 25 out of high school and 23 out of international baseball. And so what we've seen over the recent past, and this has been an evolution over years and years, but it's at least as good of a developmental situation in terms of exactly what Coach is talking about. The weight rooms are better, the facilities are better, the nutrition is important, and all of those things can kind of be emphasized in a collegiate setting that were there a little bit when he and I played, and then going back into the 50s and 60s. I remember talking to one of President Bush's teammates at Yale who played there in 47 and 48, and they, bear in mind, this is the national runner-up at the College World Series in 47 and 48. And I said, what did you guys do in fall practice? He goes, well, we didn't have fall practice. You know, and so over the years, it's changed to now there's a very much of a quality level of instruction and developmental opportunities beyond all the things that Coach talked about, social maturation and the opportunity to get close to a degree and all that. I think it's you know, we're just seeing it play out in terms of access, you know, guys making big league rosters and then guys getting to their sixth year and getting to arbitration and free agency. Those numbers are more heavily populated to college players. And so it's in that sense, I think it's better than ever.
One other thing, if you don't mind me, Roger, before you, but one of the things that I don't like about professional baseball, and I do like the fact that you go up as you get better, but the coaches are trying to do the same thing. They're trying to work their way up to become big league coaches, and they start out at the rookie league level. They may have had ability, but they might not have the ability to teach. I think that Cliff Gustafson, Augie Garrido, Wayne Graham, Skip Bertman, Larry Hayes, on and on and on, are better coaches for an 18-year-old than what you're usually going to get when you go to rookie league ball as a minor leaguer. And so I really feel that's important. I think some of the best coaches that I know, I managed in a rookie league. And I mean, not that they weren't good coaches, but they didn't have the ability to teach that the people that I just mentioned do. You played for a couple of them that I mentioned. So I think, what do you think about that, comparing those guys?
Well,
to your
simply said, when I signed as a rookie with the Red Sox, my pitching coach was a retired catcher. And not to say that he didn't know what was coming on the other end, but, you know, again, I tried to never really shut anybody down. Obviously, I listened, and there were a lot of things I couldn't use as towards my game, but there were some things that clicked for me that helped me for sure. But again, with my oldest one, Kobe, he might not say it, but I kind of wish that he would have went to college. Now, knowing what we know, and I can tell most of the high school or college players that when I got drafted and went off to play professional baseball, once I got to Double A, that's kind of where I felt that my college level was. That's the talent that I faced in college. So just a great experience, like you said. You're able to mature. I would encourage everybody, except for that exceptional kid, a top five pick or something like that, because you can go chase your dreams and come back and pay for your education, do what you want to do. And obviously you could change a family's life if that, you know, obviously the way the dollars are now in the game. So you have to weigh that. But college experience is incredible.
Let's thank our panelists for being out here. Jim Gilligan, Mike Gustafson, Roger Clemens. Thanks very much.